Thanks for downloading this podcast from The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and if you're ready, we'll begin. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Now let me strain your ears.
That our bodies in heaven and earth,
there are more things in heaven and earth. That's Alexander Graham Bell's dad reading Shakespeare's Hamlet back in the 1880s at the dawn of transmitted and recorded sound. This hour, we leap through that recorded history.
Long distance.
I've been cut off, operator.
I'm sorry. I'll try to get Lamar 2704 for you. One moment, please.
I mean that literally. The history of recording and transmitting sound from the 1880s to the present moment. These are operators back in the 1940s when the phone system was a government-regulated monopoly with strict rules for connecting and reliability. Remember the old phone? The broadcast system was also growing during the 20th century, filling the air with analog signals like this satellite broadcast of President John F. Kennedy back in the 60s.
I understand that part of today's press conference is being relayed by the Telstar communications satellite to viewers across the Atlantic, and this is another indication of the extraordinary world in which we live.
As the communication system grew, the government had something to say about everything. Licenses for broadcasters, their frequencies, even the dial tone you heard every time you picked up the old telephone. Here's the regulated phone system acting as the chrysalis for a new medium being born. The sound of internet dial-up from the 1980s, a century after Bell, something new and much, much bigger, digital, even if Katie Couric didn't quite understand it as late as 1994.
There's Allison. Can you explain what internet is?
Katie learned, eventually. So did we all. The signal you are hearing now, my voice, digitally encoded and then decoded over a broadcast signal or picked up off a flash disk from an audio file from the cloud. This signal owes its birth to those original primitive tones of Alexander Graham Bell and Thomas Edison. Today we consider the epic choice the federal government is about to make. Is the internet like a radio signal, or like a telephone, or like a broadcast network, or something completely different? The FCC chairman, Thomas Wheeler, announced yesterday that he wants to regulate the internet like a telephone monopoly, creating a system with equal access for all, net neutrality. And now, using the digital and so far unregulated medium of Skype, I'm connecting with Victor Picard, assistant professor at the Annenberg School for Communications at the University of Pennsylvania. Welcome, Victor.
Thanks for having me, John.
What do you think has happened to our challenges in regulating communications as the technology has gotten better and better and better, looking at the big arc back to the 1930s?
Yes, well, there's been an interesting evolution, but in many ways, I would argue that it hasn't changed a whole lot. You have these periodic critical junctures when we have new media, and as a society, we need to figure out how do we regulate this media? What's the social contract? What's the role of the FCC in their regulatory oversight?
When you look at Wheeler's proposal, the chairman of the FCC, do you see this keeping with the tradition, keeping with the idea that things don't change, or do you see it as a break?
I see more parallels than ruptures and discontinuities, but I would say there's been interesting differences because whereas in the 1940s, which is what I focus on, you had a fairly aggressive FCC that tended to be anti-monopoly. With Tom Wheeler, I don't think that was his initial instincts, but yet he was pushed by public pressures to essentially do a very similar New Deal-like measure against internet monopolies.
And so the internet in this net neutrality view is that it becomes like the air. It's an absolute, I mean, it's beyond, it's an Uber common carrier. Whereas private companies really want to look at the internet as more of a medium, like a commodity, like wheat, gigabytes are going to be something that's a fee-for-service kind of business almost. How much of a clash is that?
I think it's a significant clash, and I agree with you that from a business standpoint, the internet is more like a widget. It's something to be bought and sold on the market. But of course, from society's perspective, democracy depends on this, and we have to take that into consideration as we devise policy for it.
If this proposal is accepted, What are the challenges going forward, do you think, for regulators and for Americans in figuring out the best use of their own internet?
Well, there will be a number of ongoing challenges. We already know that the Republican-led Congress is seeking to undercut the FCC's regulatory authority. There have already been public announcements that AT&T, for example, will take this to court. There will be continued scrutiny as to whether there are any loopholes in these net neutrality protections. And then finally, the concern is that on February 26th, the public may declare victory and tune out when I think we need, if history gives us any lessons, we know that we need continued public engagement around these issues. Media policy is not the sexiest issue to the extent that it's even covered in the media. It often sounds overly technical and wonky. But when the public realizes what's at stake, they will engage. And I think we saw that when you, with nearly 4 million people writing into the FCC in response to their open internet rules.
As we get beyond this question of the FCC and net neutrality, how difficult is it to regulate companies that provide internet service versus regulating behavior on the internet among hundreds of millions of users?
Put that way, it would sound that it would be easier to regulate these handful of companies. I mean, we're really talking about monopolies and duopolies in most situations. But I think what we also need to be thinking about is this idea that we need public alternatives. So, for example, municipal broadband could potentially introduce competition into the internet service markets. And President Obama has come out quite forcefully in favor of this, as is the FCC.
Do you think the city of Chattanooga, which is a very progressive city on the question of internet access, should be a competitor, should be a model for internet access in terms of services designed by a Verizon or an AT&T?
From my point of view, yes. I think any competition at this point would be welcome. Right now, the U.S. Broadband speeds are quite atrocious when compared to many other democratic nations, and this stems from simply a lack of competition in the broadband market.
Victor Picard is assistant professor at the Annenberg School of Communications at the University of Pennsylvania. He's the author of America's Battle for Media Democracy, The Triumph of Corporate Libertarianism, and The Future of Media Reform. Victor, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on the show, John.
Let's pick up on one point raised by Professor Picard regarding Congress and the FCC. There is a move afoot in Congress to, by law, take the FCC out of regulating internet service altogether. Lawmakers behind this initiative have a very different idea of how the internet, private corporations, and consumers should interact. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, is with us. Welcome, Todd.
Hi, John.
So if the FCC is out of the picture, what does the regulatory environment look like based on this initiative afoot in Congress?
Yeah, well, it's not that Republicans want the FCC completely out of the picture. They just don't want what they're calling here a power grab by an agency that they say is using antiquated rules and antiquated regulations that apply to, you know, the big phone companies of sort of yesteryear and applying them to the internet. So what Republicans have been wanting to do, and there's a couple of proposals floating around, is they understand the public outcry against pay-to-play and internet fast lanes. And Republicans are well aware that most consumers and a lot of companies just don't want that. And they are volunteering to say, look, we can effectively outlaw pay-to-play. We can outlaw internet fast lanes and kind of leave it there. We don't want a broad, what's called Title II, and that's a little bit jargony, but that's the thing that bounces around Washington these days. We don't need broad Title II authority, which is the authority that the FCC wields over the big telecoms. We don't need that for the internet. So that's what we'd rather do.
Let's hear some of the voices in this debate. Here's the House Judiciary Committee Chairman Bob Goodblatt in an interview from September of last year.
We need to be very careful that we don't throw out the baby with the bathwater by inviting the FCC in to regulate the internet. And therefore, I believe the way to keep it open is through appropriate use of our antitrust laws, not through FCC regulation.
Of course, using antitrust laws is a form of regulation, too. That's Republican Bob Goodblatt from Virginia. How does he symbolize this sort of battle on the Republican side?
Yeah, what you're hearing there is sort of the Republican angst over what they're calling a power grab from the FCC, because they say the FCC has jurisdiction here, but we want it to be narrow and we want it to be focused. We don't want it to be broad. We don't want them delving into interconnection agreements between companies like, you know, Netflix and somebody like Comcast. That's up to them. You know, we don't want the government delving into those rules. Meanwhile, John, and this isn't going to surprise you, Democrats are absolutely gleeful. They've been leaning on the FCC to go big here. They've been leading on them ever since 2010, when courts threw out the FCC's original efforts to regulate this stuff. Listen to Ed Markey. He's a senator from Massachusetts.
Do you want to return to the days when a few telecommunications companies, which today we would call the broadband behemoths, control and allow them to control the avenues that we use to communicate? Or do you want a free and dynamic open market where the best ideas survive and thrive?
And it's interesting there that Markey frames this as sort of big telecom versus the consumer, whereas Greg Walden, a representative, a Republican from Oregon, casts this as sort of modern versus ancient.
We have a very important choice to make between letting three very smart and capable but unelected people at the FCC, a majority of the commission, use a statute written for another era to cobble together a regulatory scheme, and undoubtedly will end up in court for years in litigation, providing no protections but much uncertainty. Or we can do our job and craft a new law for this century through the open and transparent legislative process.
They're marching through history there on Capitol Hill. Todd Zwillick, thanks so much.
You got it, John.
Todd Zwillick, takeaway Washington correspondent.
My name is Dave Atwater. I'm calling from Pine Hill, New Jersey. And yes, I believe that our internet providers should not be allowed to prioritize traffic based on how much they get paid by content creators. Internet access should be treated like gas or electricity.
What's your comparison? Should the internet be treated like a solid or a liquid or a gas, a utility, a corporation? Tulsa, Oklahoma. No, I think it's okay for me to be able to get a little cheaper service for a little slower service. And when I get extra cash, I can upgrade. Or from Palm Beach, Florida, I feel as though we are already being forced to pay for bigger bandwidth. Where I live, if I want to watch online video movies, I have to pay for more bandwidth. Otherwise, the connect is very slow. Later this hour, the story of a very special assistant. Former personal aide to the president tells the story of what it was like to take the journey with Barack Obama to the White House.
He represents a lot to young men and women who look and sound like I do. When I visited Washington, D.C. in early 2006, you know, something struck me that, you know, there was one African-American senator out of 100. He was the 1% representing, you know, what's about 20% of the U.S. population. And I thought, you know, there wasn't going to be a better opportunity and time for me to serve my country, to serve my community. So for me, I even if he had not run for president, I felt like I was winning by being there.
It's Reggie Love, who served the president from 2007 to 2011. More from him later this hour here on The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
Now we leave the world of electronic communications to consider the continuing wars in Ukraine and Syria. The Obama administration has a decision to make to consider lethal military aid to Ukraine or stay with non-lethal humanitarian aid. Secretary of State John Kerry is in Kiev today.
We want a diplomatic resolution, but we cannot close our eyes to tanks that are crossing the border from Russia and coming in to Ukraine.
President Obama will reportedly make a decision on arming Ukrainian forces as soon as next week. Joining me now from Washington is John E. Herbst, former United States ambassador to Ukraine from 2003 to 2006 and director of the Dinu Patriciu Eurasia Center at the Atlantic Council. Welcome back to the program, Ambassador Herbst.
My pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So do you think that the giving of lethal aid, and Secretary Kerry is offering non-lethal aid today, a package worth some millions of dollars, do you think upgrading this to lethal aid puts us more in a sort of Cold War footing in this Ukrainian conflict?
I think our providing substantial military, including defensive lethal aid to Ukraine, is absolutely essential for our national security interests.
But doesn't that create suddenly a frontier where the U.S. is confronting Russia in an open-ended conflict?
If you look carefully at what Mr. Putin has been saying for the years he's been in power, and if you look at what he's been doing, you know he's conducting an aggressive campaign to revise the borders of Europe, to challenge NATO, and we have to stop him. He is committing aggression in Ukraine. Ukraine is fighting valiantly against a much stronger foe, and Ukraine can fight more effectively if it has substantial military support, including weapons from the United States. The purpose of providing defensive lethal equipment would be to deter Mr. Putin from escalating his aggression in Ukraine.
Although deterrence is one thing, rolling back the territorial gains, including Crimea, if that's even on the table, would require an investment by the United States far and above anything that's being contemplated. Wouldn't you agree?
Well, our proposal, I mean, I'm part of a group that issued a report on Monday calling for the United States to provide $1 billion for the next 3 years, $1 billion per year for the next 3 years of military assistance to Ukraine, including some lethal defensive equipment. And the purpose is to prevent further Russian aggression in Ukraine. Now, we also believe that Ukraine deserves to get back all the territory seized by the Kremlin. But this proposal for defensive military equipment is not in order to help the Ukrainian army reconquer the rest of Ukraine. It's to make it hard, or better yet, impossible for Putin to commit further aggression in Ukraine, to compel him to negotiate a serious peace, which he has not done so far. We believe providing this amount of equipment would make it much harder for Putin to achieve his objectives in Ukraine by force, so he would have to bargain in good faith. That's the purpose.
What do you see are the differences between providing lethal aid to the Ukrainians versus providing lethal aid to the opposition in Syria? And I know it's difficult to get into that business, but they're both on the table right now.
Familiar with the situation in Syria. In Ukraine, you have a competent leadership which is committed to democracy and would like to establish an open society. They are natural allies, appropriate allies of the United States. In Syria, it's chaos. Assad is a brutal dictator, but all of the effective rebel groups in Syria are extremists. So there's no natural, and some of them are also not too competent. So there's no natural partner for us in Syria. So there's a huge difference. Our strategic interests demand that we help Ukraine, because Mr. Putin is threatening stability, he's threatening democracy in Europe, in Eurasia. In Syria, it's a much more complex, harder to define problem.
Johnny Herbst is former United States ambassador to Ukraine from 2003 to 2006. He's director of the Dino Patrizio Eurasia Center at the Atlantic Council. Ambassador, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
There were airstrikes from Jordan into Syria today as Jordan responded to national calls for revenge as the king promised more direct action against ISIS and as Jordan has begun to take a higher profile in the international coalition since the death of their pilot at the hands of ISIS. That higher profile is something the U.S. has been urging for quite a while. Joining us now is Rhonda Habib. Rhonda is the author of Hussein and Abdullah Inside the Jordanian Royal Family. She is a journalist based in Jordan for Agence France-Presse. Rhonda, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
What is the feeling, the sense of the nation today?
As you know, a sense of deep, deep sorrow and shock, and that with calls for revenge. And now things are sinking in. But today there was a premiere, if I can say. Jordanians have announced officially that they carried operation, they launched airstrikes against ISIS. And this is coming after the pilot was killed. And obviously, it was really one of the answers that Jordan is going to have. The king happened to be paying condolences in Karak, which is a city in the south of Jordan where the pilot family lives. And while he was there, those planes, who had carried at dawn the operations, flew over Karak, from Karak to Amman. And the king, as I personally heard from witnesses, told the father of the pilot, Muaz Kasasbe, "You hear those planes? Those planes were sent to hit those who have killed your son."
Is the Jordanian military capable of confronting ISIS head to head?
It's very difficult to say. I mean, the Americans have been hitting ISIS and other countries of the coalition for so long. They seem to be mushrooming everywhere. But what the king has said yesterday and what the Jordanians are saying, first of all, let me explain that the Jordanians are in the coalition since September, but they have been very low-key about it because there was a kind of a movement of rejection and criticism in the street. People thought that ISIS may be in neighboring countries, but ISIS is not in Jordan, hasn't occupied Jordan, so why should we open a war with Jordan? Now, because of ISIS actions, Jordanians, at least until today, have moved from this position. And they're saying, well, this is a war that came home. They killed one of ours, so we want revenge. The acceptance of Jordan being in the coalition is today bigger. That doesn't mean that this will last for a very long time. Emotions are now influencing the decisions and the opinions. Now, Jordan is one of the best countries in the Middle East for information, for knowing who is where, for having elements infiltrating ISIS and Al-Qaeda in the past. That is true. However, militarily, the equipment and the planes that Jordan has are very old equipment. And a lot of people think that when Muaz Kasasbe was caught by ISIS, it's because there was some kind of a technical failure in the jet that he was flying.
You describe the intelligence expertise of the Jordanians, which is well known. And if you go back to the Black September period in the 1970s, the Jordanian intelligence services and the paramilitaries of the Jordanian military were feared throughout the region. And I'm wondering if we're returning to that sort of time, that level of aggression.
Well, this was a different intelligence because Black September, the fighters, the Palestinian fighters, were inside Jordan and trying to create a state within the state. But the Jordanians have proved that they can have intelligence all over. After September 11, the Americans and the Jordanians' intelligence have worked very much together. And I think that the Jordanians were able to identify a lot of the terrorists that were arrested by the United States. So I think their work now is, after 45 years, their work is more regional. And a lot of Gulf Arab countries depend on Jordan for intelligence because the country is central geographically. And also because, they've had several years, decades of experience. Now, In the ranks of the jihadists, whether it was Al-Qaeda or the founder of ISIS, which was a Jordanian, Abu Mus'ab al-Zarqawi, killed by a joint operation between the Jordanians and the Americans in 2006. He was bombed in Iraq. So it is accepted as an information that Jordanians have infiltrated those groups. So in that sense, Jordan has the capacity at least to help destroy ISIS.
Does Jordan have the capacity to absorb the refugees on a continuing basis? That's been the main impact of ISIS on Jordan in producing a huge refugee population coming out of Syria, and it's also from the civil war as well.
Absolutely not. Jordan cannot take more refugees. If you look at it from the human side, absolutely refugees should come. Again, this is a curse for the geography of Jordan. Jordan had refugees from Iraq after the two wars. Jordan now has all those refugees from Syria just because they are at the doors of the country. But the population of the refugees now, the amount, the proportion, I mean, of the refugees in Jordan is 20% of the population. This is becoming too much. And who are the refugees? Not all of them are just refugees. Some of them could be having other intentions. So I think the situation for Jordan now, who has declared an open war to with ISIS, who has for the first time made it public internally in Jordan that they are conducting airstrikes against ISIS. Jordan has to watch very carefully what will happen internally, because ISIS, as I said, is not an army and it mushrooms everywhere. They could have sleeping cells, whether in Jordan, like they have in Europe, like they had in Paris. They could have sleeping cells who will also try to take revenge from Jordan for being part of the coalition.
Rhonda Habib is a journalist based in Amman, Jordan, for Agence France-Presse. Thanks so much, Rhonda.
You're welcome.
The FCC is poised to regulate the internet in some way. What do you think? Grand Prairie, Texas, the internet is no longer a luxury. It is a day-to-day necessity, and those who have no access to it are very disadvantaged. It needs to be equal and open to all.
This is Tish in Charlotte, North Carolina. I think that net neutrality is a waste of money. I think that we all end up paying more in the end, and some people need faster service and some don't. Why pay for what you don't need?
Who do you trust? 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Support for The Takeaway comes from LegalZoom. For over 10 years, providing solutions for business owners to get legal help, including corporate filings, legal plans featuring attorney contract review, and tax advice. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
We end this hour with the amazing story of what it's like to literally walk in the footsteps of the President of the United States. In the wide shots of President Barack Obama from the 2008 campaign until 2011, you could see the smiling, sometimes nervous and exhausted face of a young man standing near the commander-in-chief. This man carried no Secret Service earpiece. He didn't hold any nuclear launch codes, but he was Barack Obama's so-called body man, special assistant and personal aide. Reggie Love was that young man who, in his early 20s, after being an NCAA champion basketball star at Duke University under the legendary coach Mike Krzyzewski, Coach K, he became candidate Barack Obama's body man, a story he tells in the book Power Forward, My Presidential Education.
He'd started running for president. I'd taken this job as a body guy. I don't really know what it is. And I'm in, like, Keene, New Hampshire. It's got to be 10 degrees outside. Snow everywhere. And I'm like running around at 6:30 in the morning trying to find a place that's open that sells eggs and bacon. And there are many moments like that in which I could say, man, this isn't that sexy or that cool. But I was able to find value in the fact that even though it's not a sexy, cool thing, it's an important part to him being able to go out into campaign for, you know, president of the United States. You know, the guy's hungry, he can't focus, he can't, you know, maybe passes out in an event or, you know, so even though it wasn't necessarily this shiny object at the time, you know, doing those little things for 6 years gave me the ability to build that relationship with him and the rest of the people in the organization.
You write this great story about how you reminded Barack Obama on a very busy, I believe it was a Martin Luther King day, where he had to give a speech, that he had like 10 minutes to get ready. And you watched him in 10 minutes when you knew he was tired make a transformation. Take me to that moment. And then he gave a speech.
Yeah. No, it was Atlanta the day after the Nevada caucus. And he'd stayed up the entire night rewriting a speech that he was going to give at Ebenezer Church. I know for a fact it was almost 3:45 when he went to sleep. And I wake up, I'm tired. And typically, you know, he would try to go to the gym. Some days, you know, he wouldn't go to the gym because you just didn't have it that day, right? And this day, you know, I kind of knock, and I knock again, and I knock again. And finally, I ask the Secret Service agent to let me in the room, and I say, I'm very nervous, and it's dark, it's a big suite, can't see anything. And I just kind of yell out, I'm like, you know, sir, I hear this loud growl come out of the room. Startles me.
Growl one.
And, you know, and I knew he was tired. And he gets up, he gets dressed. And when by the time he'd gotten dressed and we'd gotten to the church and he'd been announced to stage, you would have thought that he'd had, you know, 7 hours of sleep. He just switch and ready to go.
And he gave a speech that was way more than just a three-point shot.
Yeah, as one of the more powerful speeches that he gave throughout the campaign.
I'm not talking about the budget deficit. I'm not talking about the trade deficit. I'm talking about the moral deficit in this country. I'm talking about an empathy deficit. The inability to recognize ourselves in one another, to understand that we are our brother's keeper and our sister's keeper, that in the words of Dr. King, we are all tied together in a single garment of destiny.
Your worst mistake working for him?
The worst mistake? You know, all mistakes are bad, but the worst mistakes, I believe, are the ones that are repetitive. But I still, to this day, I beat up with a little bit of sweat every time I think about the time I left his briefcase in the car in Florida the day and a half before the first debate in Columbia, South Carolina.
All right, so he wasn't president yet. It's not like he has the launch codes, right?
No. So this is still early
on. Still.
It was very nerve-wracking. I thought I was close to losing my job.
How did you – did you find it? Did you?
I found it, and I remember when he asked me about it, and you know, I thought I was going to be able to get back to the hotel and maybe get it there before he even realizes it's gone. And we're in the car, and he goes, "Hey Reggie, where's my bag?" And I kind of look and I say, "Well, it's on the way." He was like, "What do you mean it's on the way? Shouldn't it be in the car?" I was like, "Yeah, but it's, you know, it kind of got left behind in one of the cars, and it's, you know, 5.5 hours behind us." But
how hard was that to say?
It was very hard to say.
The bacon and eggs is all over your face.
Face, pants, shoes, hair.
And he forgave you? He threw a fit? What happened?
He's very calm about it. I think he was, you know, he sat me down a few hours later. He said, "Look, if you're not up to do this job, and I'm sure someone else will be." That was it. And, you know, from there on, it was kind of the ship had been set a course, and I tried not to. Now, granted, you know, I'm not perfect, and I feel like there are a lot of things that happened that went wrong that probably weren't my fault that I definitely took credit for.
Well, good for you.
But, you know, that's part of the deal. You know, a lot of these things you're figuring out as some of these things you're doing for the first time. I'd never, you know, prepared for a state dinner before. I'd never, you know, been to China before. There's no manual.
What question scares you the most that you're going to be asked on this tour?
The question.
Because I know it.
Oh, you know it?
Yeah. You were the guy that carried the cigarettes, right?
I was the guy that carried the cigarettes. I mean, I may have smoked a cigarette here and now and then, but I don't know that I'm necessarily the cigarette carrier.
For Barack Obama.
Yeah.
No, did he quit?
I mean, that was part of the deal. The deal was that he was going to quit smoking if he ran for president. He made that deal with his wife, and you know, he successfully did do it. That's a good question, though.
That's a good question. you had a front row seat for that one.
Yeah.
Before we go, where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Charlotte, North Carolina.
North Carolina. And you go back to the neighborhood where you grew up and the people, the folks, yeah?
I do get back to the neighborhood every now and then.
What question did they ask you about what you've seen?
You know, everyone wants to know if there's, like, aliens. How it's like people want to know, what kind of basketball player is the president really like? Like, can he actually play? I'm like, yeah, he can play basketball. He's like, he makes the people he plays with better. And I don't know where the aliens are.
Darn. I thought we were going to make some news here. Reggie Love, thanks so much.
Thank you, John. I appreciate you having me today.
Reggie Love was special assistant and personal aide to President Barack Obama from 2007 to 2011. He shares his coming-of-age story in the new book, Power Forward, My Presidential Education. Should the internet be open and free? Should you pay for the internet? We always love to hear from you. Join the conversation absolutely without question, Ogden, Utah says. If fast lanes are put in, you'll never see another internet startup again. Charlotte, North Carolina, I live in rural Dorchester County. I can have electricity, it is a utility, but the cable company refuses to provide me with a wire even though it hangs on the very same poles. If they were a utility, I might get wired in. Your thoughts on net neutrality? The FCC is poised to vote on it. Tell us what you think at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm Jay Hockenberry, or check us at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.